Hello and welcome to another installation of SciFlix here at Tune FM. I'm your host, Bridget Glover, and I'm so excited to kick off the SciFlix podcast again for another year. In case you don't know, SciFlix is a collaboration between Belgrave Cinema, Tune FM, and UNE Life here in Armidale, where we get to talk, we get to watch science-themed films on the big screen, and we get to hear from an expert afterwards and do like a Q&A. It's really, really fun. The next film we have coming up will be the 1997 film Volcano, and that will be on the 7th of March at 6 p.m. sharp. Students will be back on campus. It's going to be the perfect way to kick off trimester one. I'm really excited. We've got our expert here today, Dr. Kieran Meaney. He is an expert on all things geological. He is a team leader and resident geologist at UNE Discovery Voyager, and he's committed to science communication. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Kieran.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, starting from the beginning, I just want to know what drew you to geology.
Long answer.
Please.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes stories.
Oh, yes. That's perfect.
So as a kid, I used to love reading Sherlock Holmes, and there was one story that really stuck in my mind. It wasn't even about a crime. It was just about a man that had lost a hat. Well, they'd found a hat. They bring it Holmes, and Holmes looks at this hat and goes, well, the man you're looking for, the owner of this hat, he lives on the east side of town between such and such street and the river. He's in his mid-40s with neat hair, but he might look a little bit disheveled because he's fallen on hard times financially, which might explain why his wife has ceased to love him.
Amazing.
At which point everyone else in the room is going, what the heck, Holmes? How did you figure that out? And he goes through all the points. There's a drop of candle wax on the hat, so the electricity hasn't been installed in the house yet, so he must live in this certain block, which is the last one that hasn't got the electricity installed. The hat is very expensive originally, but is 10 years old and getting a bit ratty, so it hasn't been replaced. So obviously this man had money once upon a time, but hasn't got the money now to replace the hat and keep his... and that sort of logical reasoning really resonated with me. And in geology, we do exactly the same thing. You're looking for these tiny little details in the rock that tell you these enormous billion-year stories. So, you know, even just a piece of sandstone, the size of each piece of sand tells you how much energy was in the water that was moving that sand particle around. If they're very coarse, you had really rapid, fast-flowing water. If it's very fine, then it was very calm, still water. You know, the shape of the grain of sand, if it's got these sharp angular points, it hasn't tumbled along a river. It hasn't been, hasn't travelled very far. So it's still fairly close to where it eroded out of a rock. If it's very smooth, it's probably been in the environment a lot longer. So, you know...
That's amazing.
You know, it's just these simple little things like the shape of a grain of sand can tell you huge stories.
Yeah.
And once you start, you know, stacking, going through the layers of rock and putting all those little stories together, you get these really big, beautiful, you know, billion-year stories of how the Earth and the environment has changed. So that's what really drew me to it.
Absolutely. No, I can totally understand that.
And I also love shiny things.
I love shiny things too. I don't know why I didn't get into it, but I don't know if the audience can tell yet, but I'm not a scientist, so I'm just coming along for the ride. You're a resident geologist and presenter at UNE Discovery Voyager. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that amazing program and what sort of led you to transition from research to science communication?
Well, I'll start with the transition because that's easy. I didn't like research. It just wasn't the right fit for me. Like, when I was doing my PhD, I was crippled with anxiety half the time. It was a very stressful environment that could just be in part the institution I was at. I found UNE to be a much more fun and relaxed environment to work in. But, you know, still the pressure of deadlines to publish or perish, you know, it's this... I didn't really love that aspect of it, and you know, watching these career academics, you know, spend their weekends trying to get papers published. I was like, actually, I want to do something a little bit different with my life.
Cool. Sounds like a lot more fun as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it's one of these things. I always, you know, try and tell people that it's perfectly okay to change your mind, and you know, if you give something a go and you find out it's not actually like you thought it was going to be, then there's nothing wrong with saying, actually, no, I'm going to do what fits best for me.
Absolutely.
Those people that really excel at research and publishing papers, like, they are my heroes, but that's just not me. I am good at talking. I don't shut up. So like, I just made a career out of that instead. When I was doing my PhD, I did a lot of teaching. If there was any schools that came to visit the University of Adelaide where I was, I'd quite often get tasked with, taking them around the museum that we've got there just telling
you
them
were
all
like
about
edging towards it for
yeah.
sure.
But yeah, yeah, it was. Yeah. There was lots of little things that just kept nudging me in that direction until eventually I settled there.
That's
As for the discovery program, we love to make science fun, basically. Mm. So we present to kids as young as kindergarten. We go up to about year 10. So we're trying to catch the interest in science of kids while they're still deciding what they want to do. So,
yeah, exactly.
A lot of programs will go out and they'll just talk to year 11 and 12 students and say, come and do this uni degree. But by that point, they've already started choosing their HSC subjects and they're already sort of set on a path. So we try and get in nice and early and just to instill a love of science.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking, like, I don't really feel like I had any primary school interactions with science that much, except for, nothing. Like, probably just some bizarre experiment at the end of the year or something. And it was fun, but you don't really necessarily know if it's something that you might find particularly interesting or that you might be good at.
Yeah.
I think that's amazing. That sounds perfect. What activities do you find especially popular among students?
Now, not to be biased, but our geology and paleontology units. Chemistry is undoubtedly our most popular topic. Last year we introduced a new activity, which is set in a museum, but it's an escape room. So we set up the classroom as the escape room. They've got to find clues in, the specimen tags and
so cool.
Spell out words with the periodic table and things like this. So that one's been very popular as well. It's just basically any science that we can turn into a game.
Yeah.
Really, the philosophy we take to discovery is play-based learning. So I like to think of it as, not in a malicious way, but tricking the kids into learning. They don't realise that they're learning things because they're having so much fun while they're doing it.
Exactly right. Yeah. No, and that's obviously what all of my favourite teachers did. Mm-hmm. So I can understand how it's kind of taken hold. But I'm wondering as well if there are some kids that ever go in and they're just like, oh, whatever, this is, like, I'm not interested. And then, or are they just always super pumped to be there?
Depends if we've been to the school before.
Yeah.
If they see our truck rock up, they're like, yes, they're back.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
If we haven't been to the school before, I've had heaps of kids sort of rock in, pun intended. I pull out a box of rocks and some magnifying glasses and you get the eye rolls of, oh, we're just looking at rocks.
Yeah,
45 minutes later, they're out digging in the garden going, oh, what's this one? What's this one? I was like, I just know I've got them.
Exactly. Yes, that's the key.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a really basic question.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to know the difference between dormant, active, and extinct when it comes to sort of labelling volcanoes or looking at them.
Yes.
Explain this to me.
There is a straightforward, not quite right answer or a very elaborate, slightly more precise answer, but there's shades of grey. The broad rule of thumb is an active volcano is anything that has erupted during the Holocene, which is the last 12,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you use that definition, Mount Gambier in South Australia is an active volcano because that erupted 5,000 years ago.
Wow.
We do not have any evidence that that's going to erupt again, to my knowledge. I'm happy to be corrected on that. So whether or not you'd still consider that an active volcano, who knows, maybe we'll get a Los Angeles scenario where a volcano just suddenly erupts out of the blue one day.
Yeah.
It couldn't. a dormant volcano is one that is likely to erupt again but hasn't erupted in the last 12,000 years.
Oh, okay.
So something like Yellowstone would probably have been the most famous dormant volcano. We know that one's going to erupt again because we've got all these, the geysers, the magma's heating up that groundwater and, shooting it up into the air. So we've got these hot springs sitting above it. So we know there's magma there. We know it's going to erupt again. It's a little bit overdue, which...
What? That's crazy. Okay.
And then extinct is just anything that's not going to erupt again. But we've had volcanoes that we've classified as extinct that have suddenly rumbled back into life.
This means nothing then.
it is that classic case of nature not giving a toss at all about exactly. The boxes we want to put it in.
No, that's, you can't be ruled out. And so that leads me on to the local volcanoes around the New England area. Mm-hmm. Because I did some Googling about you and I saw that you had been to a few. And I just want to know,
just out of curiosity, was that me or was that George in inverted commas?
Okay. So there's George the geologist who is, twin?
My doppelganger? There is a photo somewhere online of the two of us in the same room. We're both definitely not the same person.
Right.
It's definitely not photoshopped.
Look, listen, it did catch me and I was like, oh, he's a twin and he's twins into science. This is great. What a jackpot. No, it's just Photoshop got me again. I just want to know what you found out about these places or what George found out about these places.
Yeah. So just for full transparency, George the geologist is my character that I play, who bears a striking resemblance.
Shocking.
To me. So there's a few videos of George out there. For the local New England volcanoes, there's two periods of volcanic activity in New England. Mm-hmm. One was at the end of the Permian era, 252 million years ago. These were super eruptions, the likes of which the Earth has not seen since. The pile of ash has been calculated to have been about 30 kilometres thick and stretched as far as Sydney and northern Queensland.
Oh, my God.
So, unsurprisingly, shortly after these volcanoes erupted, 95% of all life on Earth died. One of the contributing factors to the biggest mass extinction event on Earth, and the volcano is the centre of it. It would be 100 km north of Armidale here. So
that is incredible.
Tim Chapman and Luke Milan had a great paper out a couple of years ago about just that. And,
really.
That's...
God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then more recently, in the last 30 to 15 million years ago, there was volcanoes, just like we see in the movie, actually, these basaltic volcanoes that produce great big rivers of lava that flood across the landscape. So great big what we call shield volcanoes, if you imagine Captain America's shield flat on the ground. That's the sort of shape these volcanoes make.
Okay.
Because the lava is very runny, they spread out a long way. An interesting feature that we get up here actually is that the lava flowed down, river valleys and gullies. And once it cooled down, that rock was much harder than the surrounding rock. So the sides of the valleys have eroded down because they're softer, leaving the middle of the valley now the high point. So it's actually inverted the landscape due to that volcanic rock.
Oh my God.
So it's quite interesting.
I'm wondering how I get there. how do I get there to go and have a look? Because, is it near Point Lookout?
Point Lookout is, probably the best place to see the Ybor volcano. Mm-hmm. So the volcanic rock is very easily seen from Ybor Falls.
Okay.
You can actually see the columnar basalt. So as it cools, it breaks into these hexagonal pillars.
Cool.
So if you've ever seen Giant's Causeway, it's... that's the most spectacular example. But,
sorry, guys. I feel like I've seen a photo of that actually. With the pillars. When I was doing my Googling.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, that leads us onto the film really nicely, actually, because I was reading about the film, and I read that they had a scientific advisor on the set who said that the likelihood of LA having a volcano erupt is super low, basically not for a few million years. But Dr. Amy Barnes essentially says that wherever there's earthquakes, you could have an eruption. Can you settle this for me, please?
I'd like to know where Dr. Amy Barnes got her degree.
Yeah, I know. She's got a lot of explaining to do.
look, there's... as a geologist, she does some good work in the film, but she also says some things that make geologists just want to pull their hair out.
Oh, I bet.
So when she's describing the, where volcanoes come from, it's kind of like, that's great, but almost nothing you said was right.
so close.
So it's kind of the other way around, actually. Where we get volcanoes, we tend to get earthquakes. But where we have earthquakes doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get a volcano. Mm. So in Los Angeles, there's a very famous fault, the San Andreas Fault,
mm-hmm.
Which has been the focus of its own movies.
Yes, true.
Looking at you, Dwayne Johnson. And that type of fault is called a transform fault. So the rocks on either side of a fault is just a break, a crack in the Earth's crust where rocks are moving on either side. So in a transform fault, the rocks are moving from side to side. Neither side's going up or down. So we can get strong, shallow earthquakes in those types of environments, but we usually do not get volcanoes in those environments unless there's some other factor creating that volcano, like a hotspot or whatever it is. So there's a reason there are no volcanoes in Los Angeles right now, and it's because they don't really form in that environment at all.
What?
So for a volcano to just suddenly pop up, you would need something like a Hawaiian-style hotspot.
Sure.
A mantle plume coming up that's completely unrelated to the crack in the crust.
Right. Okay.
the biggest gripe I've got with that scene is that she describes the mantle, that layer of the earth below the crust, as liquid. That is wrong.
As
one of my old professors used to say, if you picked up a piece of the mantle and threw it at someone, it would hurt because it is solid. it is not going to splash. It is solid in the same way that glacial ice or plasticine is solid. So it can flow and move over time, but it's not just like if you suddenly had a crack sitting right above it, it's just going to suddenly burst like a pimple.
One strike against her name already.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of characters that are just wandering around in this film without any protective gear on, and I was watching it and I was concerned. I've got some questions about the sort of the harmfulness or the toxicity of some of these things regarding volcanoes, such as, the ash. Is it something that will hurt people? Is it going to get into our lungs if I happen to, wander near a volcano and it erupts? Am I going to die a few years later?
If you don't die immediately, yes, you might die a few years later. Okay, so...
it's just all in their hair and on their face.
The ash is one of the most debated points on this movie. I was also doing some Googling just to, prime myself before I rewatched it. And the volume of ash that we get in this movie is not really realistic to this type of volcano. Some people online would like to say that you would get no ash from this type of volcano, and I disagree with that.
Okay.
You would get some.
Okay.
But you see it just like pretty much every scene after the volcano erupts, there is just ash raining down constantly.
Yes.
And it is big, beautiful snowflake-like ash.
Yes.
That's rubbish.
Okay. It just sits on their hair. It's crazy.
So what volcanic ash actually is shards of volcanic glass.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
So where it comes from, as the volcano is erupting, you've got all the gas that is dissolved into the lava, which could be coming from a variety of different sources. But when the volcano erupts, it's like taking the lid off a shaken-up can of soft drink.
Yes.
So all of the gas dissolved in the drink or the lava, is suddenly free to just fizz out everywhere. Sorry, I'm just punching the microphone as I gesticulate.
We're just getting a bit outraged.
So with the lava, it's cooling down and trying to solidify into rock as that process is happening. So you've got this sort of semi-solid rock with a bubble inside that's trying to expand because pressure's coming off, and then those bubbles pop.
I see.
And then you just get these little shards of glass getting flicked up into the air.
Oh my god, that's horrifying.
Yes, it is. the ash that we see in the movie looks like they've just taken a bunch of newspapers and just like grilled it, and then they're just like
literally
blowing it everywhere. It looks like paper ash, and that's not what it's going to look like at all.
That's far worse than I was expecting.
Sorry.
Yes. I was just going to say, you kind of talked about it, but the lava doesn't kind of give off any toxic gas or anything like that. Like, you know, they're in these tunnels and there's lava around. Like, is anything going on there?
Oh, they're dead.
They're dead. Yeah, all right, cool. Yeah.
There's, I treat this movie as a comedy.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Comedy of errors. Mm. Because there is that laugh out loud scene at the start where all the volcanic gases just get sucked back down into the crack.
Oh,
and I'm just
like,
yeah, no, that's fine. We'll just completely... Whoever the scientific advisor was obviously didn't...
Who is that person?
See that scene at all.
I had so many questions about that because what the hell was that? I don't even know.
Yeah, no, there is literally no way that is feasible to suck the gas down. You'd have to...
It looked cool, though, guys.
It looked cool.
Yeah.
And it was quite obviously filmed in reverse. They just shot the gas out and then reversed the film.
It was a bit of a jump scare, so that is fine.
But in terms of the gas that's coming off, you quite often get large amounts of carbon dioxide, which in some places in the world has been known to sort of like, because it's heavier than most of the other gases in the air, it can pool.
Yeah.
So if it sort of flows into a valley, it can just asphyxiate anything in the bottom of the valley. There's a couple of recorded incidents of that happening.
Wow.
I'm plunging the depths of my memory now. I think it was the African Rift Valley where we were getting a couple of incidents like that. But I would have to go and fact check myself.
We can have a bit of a Google.
Well,
actually, speaking of lava pooling up, that's part of Dr. Amy's plan, that if you let the lava pool up and then just dump a bunch of water on it, it will form a crust and just kind of stop in its tracks. I'd like to know if that's going to work.
Cool. Look, the most effective way to control the lava in this situation would be their later method of sticking dynamite in the ground and carving a trench.
Yeah.
It's just so much water, guys. I have got so many problems with that scene. I could go into the structural engineering of the concrete dam that they created, which was facing the wrong direction, and the concrete would break down from the heat.
That's what I thought too.
You've got, I mean, none of those fire trucks that they're using to prop them up would be driving again afterwards, being that close to lava.
Right.
But just the thing to remember about this lava, for it to be flowing like it does, it would need to be at about 1,200 degrees Celsius.
Right.
Ripping hot. Water boils at 1,100 degrees less.
Yeah, exactly right.
So... particularly if you've got a spray of water with small droplets, most of that's going to actually be evaporating before it hits the lava.
That's what I thought, guys, okay? Just have that on record. I thought it was silly too.
Yeah, but Dr. Amy does say that they use this method to stop the lava flow in Iceland. I Googled this. This was a thing that they did actually try. There was a fishing village, and what was happening was the lava was... basically going to block up the entrance to the harbour and just cut off their whole economic structure of, you know, the fishing boats can't come back in. So they were trying to stop the lava before it got to the harbour. And so what they were doing, they were out in boats with big pumps and hoses, and they were basically pumping water out of the ocean onto the lava to try and cool it down. And what happened was the volcano stopped before it worked.
Oh, that was lucky. She didn't mention that part.
Yeah, no. So they didn't... They can't say for sure if it would have worked, but the other thing in that scenario was they were in boats on the ocean with a basically infinite supply of water.
Right, exactly.
They could just keep pumping onto it.
Exactly. Minor details. Yeah. Okay, all right. So speaking of the heat of the lava, I've read that you would die instantly if, you know, you happen to... jump into it. I've read that you wouldn't melt, but that you'd die slowly over 22 minutes. So spoiler alert for anyone who's not seen it, we have our amazing character Stan, who has this heroic death scene where he jumps from the train into the lava flow. I want to know what would actually happen to Stan. I mean, aside the fact that if he's down there in that tunnel, he's probably already dead. Let's just move away from that. If he's jumping into the lava, what's going to happen?
I'm glad you pointed out he was probably dead before he could jump off the train. In a confined space like that, if you've got the lava coming down, the tunnel, the air is just going to be superheated because it's got no way to cool off. So they would have all died of heat stress long before the lava got to them. But ignoring that, let's say we're out in the open. The train is on the surface and we have to jump off into the lava. The thing about lava is that it's heavy. So in the same way oil is going to float on top of water, the human body is not heavy enough to actually sink through liquid lava. Whoa. So you're not going to sink into it. You're not going to have a Wicked Witch of the West style I'm melting death scene.
Okay.
There would be a lot of screaming, but you won't sink into it. So what would happen would be more akin to slapping a steak onto a red hot barbecue. Sorry for the visceral image.
Oh, Stan.
So he probably would have lost his leg. Well, he certainly would have lost his legs. There is a chance he could have survived, though, if they had managed to grab him and pull him out.
Goodness me. Okay.
There's a few different factors at play as to how long you would live in contact with the lava. And one of the biggest things is that heat takes time to transfer into whatever object it's transferring into. This is why you can touch the stove and don't do this, by the way. But if by accident your hand touched the stove, you get a quick burn, you jerk your hand away, and it's just the surface layer of skin that gets burned. It's not like your whole hand suddenly ignites. Sure. It takes time for that heat to pass through.
Okay.
So, you stand a fighting chance of survival if you're not touching it for very long.
Oh, gosh, imagine that.
But the heat radiating off of this lava at 1,200 degrees is enough to kill you on its own without touching the lava if you're too close to it for too long.
Sure.
So... if you see documentary footage of scientists, poking lava and sampling lava, they're usually in those silver heat-resistant spacesuit-looking things.
Exactly, yes.
Because it's hot.
It's hot.
I think that's one of the things that really doesn't get addressed enough in this movie, is just how hot this lava is.
Yeah, look, he's walking through the train and his boots are getting really sticky because it's so hot, and I was like, yeah, fair call. But... as it turns out, it's probably just far worse than that, and all of them being, lying down in the train and they've passed out because they're so hot. I'm like, they're dead, guys. Like, why are we even bothering?
They have roasted by that.
Yeah.
I appreciate the effort to check try and save them, but there's only so much you can do, unfortunately.
That's so true. Okay, so Volcano came out in 1997, and bizarrely, that same year, like 2 months prior, Dante's Peak was released. We know that the 90s were the golden age of disaster movies, but I think that's weird. Any ideas on why volcanoes were a particular source of fear in the late 1990s? I want to know if there was some... significant string of eruptions, or was it just part of that growing climate awareness?
I'm not sure if it was climate awareness, because unless I missed it while I was raging at the movie. I don't think anyone mentioned anything to do with the climate.
No. You're right.
There was, in 1980, the eruption of Mount St. Helens, which was a deadly eruption in America that covered a huge... I'd have to check how far the ash cloud went, but it did go... covered a fairly substantial part of the US. And of course, they've been talking about Yellowstone being a super eruption waiting to happen for a long time.
Maybe back then they were like, any day now.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been saying any day now for decades.
Crazy.
I think in certain places in the US, there is a heightened awareness of volcanism. Hawaii's got them erupting constantly.
Yeah, really?
But again, just these sort of casual lava flows that just, you know, they just get about their day. They don't blow everything up.
No, I know.
It is quite weird. I suspect there was something to do with the competitiveness of the movie, producing companies, because the following year I noticed you had Armageddon and Deep Impact.
Yeah, constant, titles clashing against each other.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think also maybe... like CGI, maybe they were getting excited about what they could do. I don't know.
I mean, that was, I'm sure that would have played a part, especially after Jurassic Park's.
Totally.
Amazing CGI in 1993 that still holds up.
Exactly. All right, so do we need more volcano representation in the 2020s? Can we do better?
Can we do better?
Can we do better?
Look, we could. There were certain elements of volcano that were realistic. The lava flowing down the street, you know, I expect the producers would have seen enough footage of, you know, Hawaiian style eruptions with similar effects. I think the general public has an awareness of what a volcanic eruption looks like. I think we could get a little bit more, we could improve on the accuracy of why they erupt and what the human effect is. How close could you actually get to that lava before you
I would combust? Like to know, definitely.
There's always room for improvement, but then there's always the sacrifice of, do we go super accurate and just not
scare
have any
everyone.
Not have any cool action scenes?
Well, I don't know. I think the sounds of how someone would actually die in lava would be pretty gnarly, so that could be all right. But I would like to see... a geologist, you know, representation that's like not hair pulling, like so frustrating, so incorrect. That would be nice, but
yeah.
we'll see.
A geologist that is actually susceptible to volcanic ash. The amount of times there's been a few movies now where there's just like enormous clouds of volcanic ash raining down, and people just like run through it happily, or they can outrun the flow of volcanic ash. No, you can't.
Really?
Those things move like bullet trains.
Gosh, in the movie it looks kind of slow, but I think, I'll just go down the other street or something.
See, the lava that we see in this movie, they've kind of merged two types of volcanic eruption together to make this. Which is not completely impossible, but it's unrealistic. but with the lava flowing down the street like that, that's realistic for a certain type of volcanic eruption.
Okay.
The massive plumes of volcanic ash is more realistic for a different type of volcanic eruption with a different lava composition.
They just put all the things together.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Just to make it...
You've got to sell tickets.
Yeah,
fair call. All right. We'll wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming
and
chatting with me today. I'm learning so much with these podcasts. I will see you on March 7th at 6 p.m. I'll see you all then. Can't wait. Thank you.